Hi, everybody. My name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
John. Boy, and you guys are my home. I have had the pleasure of telling my story from several podiums, and I've heard my story lots of times. When Craig asked me to come tonight and to do this for you guys, I was pretty excited. It was a neat deal for me because to share my story with my home group is more of a privilege than it would be to share my story with people that are not my family. The faces in this room are people, a lot of them that were here when I got here. Michael, who did a wonderful job of the 10 minutes, he was here when I got here. He was one of the guys that took me by the hand at the Kiss Club back in 1996 when I showed up. And there's a lot of faces and a lot of stories and a lot of history in this room for me. And it's kind of neat getting to come here and do this. But today's not a good day for me. It's just been a lousy, crappy couple of days, and I don't have my usual story with me tonight. So I'm going to do the best I can. I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous in 1996, and I was beaten. I crawled into the Kiss Club. I had been crawling into clubs for the last 3 years. I'd been getting sober for 8 or 10 or 12 days, and then I'd been getting drunk, and then I'd been getting sober, and then I'd been getting drunk. I had gotten 2 30-day trips. I had lied about 60 days once. And that was my career of sobriety. I was in Orange County, California, and I had gone from being the national spokesperson for an international company. Really, when Bill says I had arrived, I was 22 years old, and I was making a lot of dough, and I had company credit cards, and I was on national television. And for a 22-year-old, that was doing pretty good. And before I knew it, I was 27, 26, 27, and I was homeless, and I didn't think I was. If you'd have asked me, I'd have told you, oh, no, I might be staying at a halfway house for right now. But I got there all by myself, and so that made a difference in my mind. I'd been to indigent detox, which I'm a guy that has insurance. What am I doing in a county-run facility, for God's sakes? Just bad planning. But that was where I'd been, and I left Orange County because my father, I went to see him, and I'm one of those guys, maybe you're like this, I'm one of those guys that I'm not hurting nobody but myself, and I don't want your lectures, I want a little sympathy, maybe a little help, perhaps you can give me a leg up or a hand up, but I don't want you looking down at me and talking down to me, because I ain't hurting nobody but myself, and I believed it. And I go to see my dad one more time for another 20, 30, 40 bucks, whatever I could get from him, with another sob story about how bad luck and people that didn't like me had wound me up in trouble one more time. And, you know, if only I could catch a break and maybe you can help me, Pops, and if I could just get a few bucks, everything will be okay. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and, of course, I was half lit up because I was awake. And that's how you could tell that was going. So, but he says to me, crying, he says, Sheldon, do you hate me so much that you have to smoke that crap and drink that crap before you come and see me? And I kind of blew it off, you know. Hey, Pops, it ain't about you. Ha, ha, ha. I get loaded before I brush my teeth. Ha, ha, ha. You know, can I have the money now so I can? But another little piece of whatever was good in me, if there was much good left, died that day. And I knew it was time for me to get out of Orange County, and Vegas seemed like a good place for me to come because, you know, leaving Las Vegas had just been on around that time, and I thought I could come here, and because I'm overly dramatic, incredibly selfish, and way too sensitive for my own good. And I thought coming to Vegas so I could quietly die and disappear into the neon, oh, it was my plan. It's not what I told everybody. What I told my family was that I was going to move to Vegas to open a beef jerky factory. You're laughing, but this is my life, for crying out loud. I there was a friend of mine that had a marketing degree, and he was the marketing whiz, and There was another guy that was a chef, and he had this recipe for jerky, and I'm a salesman, and I was going to sell it. And the marketing guy was so good at marketing that he was driving a cab, and the chef, it turned out, was working at the Horseshoe as a fry cook. And all great salespeople live in halfway houses, so you can tell where I was at. And I never even tasted the jerky. I never even tasted the stuff. We sat around and did what we do and talked how we talked, and I showed up at the Kiss Club. And I showed up that day, and I'd been showing up there for a little while, but I showed up on July 17th, 1996, like I had often showed up in clubs. And there's a guy here who saw me in Orange County showing up at those clubs. And the way that I showed up was always the same. It was, I'm the, this time it's different, man. I'm going to make T-shirts one day and sell them at AA conferences and say, this time it's different. Because this time it was always different. It was always different this time. This time it's different. This time it's different. This time, last time I got sober because I wanted to keep my job. But this time it's different. I'm doing it for her. Last time I got sober, I was doing it for her. But this time it's different. I'm doing it for me. Whatever. But it's always, nothing was ever different. I showed up and sat in the room and played cards and judged and learned. I'm a cliche learner. I go to the 7 a.m. meeting and I watch you guys and someone shares something that the rest of the room goes, oh. And I go, yeah, huh. And at noon I go to the meeting and I share it as if it were my own. And some of you are impressed and most of you are mildly amused, and then I get drunk. And then I get sober, and then I get drunk, and then I get sober. And then I get drunk. And if you could have asked me in July 96 why I was there, if I could have been honest, I couldn't have been honest. But if I could have been honest, I would have told you that I was there simply to rest. What do you mean? Well, catch my breath between drunks. You going to get drunk again? Well, yeah. Why? I don't know. But I always do. When? Inevitably. I don't know when. Could be today, could be tomorrow, could be 30 days. But I'm going to get drunk again. Because I always get drunk again. Because I don't know why. People say things like, you got to get in touch with God. With who? With God. I don't know much about God. I still don't know much about God. But I get sober and I get loaded and I get sober and I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If there's anybody that's here tonight that has gone through what I went through or isn't going through what I'm going through or has managed to do what I couldn't do, that has managed to withstand the pain, which I could not withstand, but has managed to withstand the pain and not pick up a drink, but has died in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to sit in these rooms and not recover and watch people recover. And so I drink, and then I get sober, and then I get drunk. I remember my first drunk. I remember it, which I don't think that that is a prerequisite for having alcoholism. You may not remember your first drunk, but I remember mine. And it's funny that I do. You could look at me, and you could see that I like Snickers, right? I don't remember my first Snickers. There was one, right? But I don't remember it. But I remember my first drunk. I was with a kid called Barry. We went to a liquor store, and we stood out. I was 9. He was 11. We stood in front of a liquor store in my hometown in Leeds, England, until somebody would take our money and go inside and buy us a bottle of Old English apple cider. It's just apple juice with a kick. And we went. And we got that apple juice, and we went into this wooded area, and we drank it. And I'm a nose puker, is what I am. Nose puking is a specialty, because you get that weird burning sense at the top of your nose. Some of you know, some of you don't. But I'm a nose, and I puked out of my nose. Something happened to me that day, though, that I have heard many people describe in many different ways. And here's my story. Before that drink, I'm a short, fat Jewish kid that his parents have gotten divorced, and we moved from a good neighborhood to a bad neighborhood where they don't particularly like Jews. and I'm lonely and I'm an outcast and I'm uncomfortable and I don't like it. I don't like my mom. I don't like my dad for leaving. I don't like my brother. I don't like me. I just don't like. I don't like being a short, fat Jewish kid from a broken home. I take a drink of Old English apple cider. Nothing really happened, but it felt somehow like my parents got back together. Like I grew 6 inches, like I lost 40 pounds, like my nose shrank, like my foreskin grew back. It just felt good, you know, and I liked it. I always liked it. I puked and I didn't care. I liked drinking. I'm not a good drunk. Some of you are great drinkers. Some of you can carry bottles in your back pocket and you can drink and nobody knows you're drunk, right? You can drive better, walk better, talk better. I'm a mess. I'm two beers and I either spill my beer or pee in the closet or something. I'm not a good drinker. I'm not good at it. I'm not. And somebody offered me some drugs and you know, I only have one thing to share with you, and that is my story. And if the fact that I did drugs upsets you, I apologize. But that's all I got is my story. And I did a lot of drugs. And I like them because they're tidier for a guy like me. And when I was 16, I moved to California, and I got hooked up in California, and I love drinking, and I love doing drugs. I heard somebody from a podium one time say that their very, very worst day in Alcoholics Anonymous was better than their best day drinking. And I wonder what they were drinking. Because I have had some drunks that have blown the socks off of my best days in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember one day always sticks in my mind. Any of you guys that know me or heard my story have heard me talk about this one day. It was one day, it was in the springtime, and it was at the Shoreline Amphitheater in San Jose, California. And the Grateful Dead were playing. And Shoreline is a steep amphitheater, and I was at the back of the grass, and I was on 4 hits of windowpane. And it was kind of foggy, but not raining, but kind of raining, but not really raining. And there's thunder and lightning going on in the distance, and the band starts to play, it looks like rain, and I'm having a spiritual experience the likes of which no 12-step call has ever given me. Oh. Me and God were partying, baby. Boy, if it still worked like that, boy, a sufficient substitute, you would not be. you know, but because I love that. I love partying. I loved all of it. I just loved it. But it came to an end. It ran its course. It went through what you hear the cliches in AA about. It went from being fun to fun and a little trouble to a little fun and a little trouble to very little fun and a lot of trouble to no fun at all and nothing but trouble. And that's kind of the path that I went down. I went down the path that we all follow. And I wound up in 1996 a broken man. People said things to me that blew my mind. I tell you, the first time I heard them, I've been thrown out of my dad's house, thrown out of my best friend's house, thrown out of anywhere I can live. I got nowhere to go. I end up, Dad puts me in a hotel, which I love Al-Anon. Al-Anon found my mom, and because of the work she did in Al-Anon, me and her have a beautiful relationship today. My dad, I'm grateful to say, never found Al-Anon. So he used to give me his credit card and all kinds of goofy stuff, and you know, and that was good for me. And he gave me his credit card, and I went to stay at a hotel, and for the first time ever, I got a glimpse of me the way that the people saw me, and I got to see me as a taker and a user and a just a bad apple, just a guy, not the guy that Mrs. Fetty tried to raise. You know, I said to my sponsor one time, "How's a nice Jewish boy like me end up in Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "You might be Jewish, but nice you ain't." And that's a true story. I get to this hotel and I see, and I get on the, I called a different hotline than ours, but our guy was answering the phone that day because they didn't have nobody. And he invited me to a meeting and I went to the meeting and the meeting was beautiful. There was a lady there who emotionally feels like it was Andrew Diller. It was a little Mexican lady, older lady, and it probably wasn't her, but reminds me, the picture in my mind reminds me of her. Might have been her, but it's that kind of person. Very different than me. She's old, I'm young. She's a woman, I'm a guy. She's Catholic, I'm Jewish. I'm short, but she's really short. And she started to tell her story, and Aura D out of L.A. says that the pain in her reached out and touched the pain in this other person. And there was nothing good in me to touch that day, but there was plenty of pain, and something in that lady reached out and touched me. And I didn't hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous the way you hear it talked about. I didn't hear the laughter and the joy that night, but I felt recognition. I knew that there were people in that room because they laughed at the same places. I kind of was amused, and they cried at the same places. I wept, and I kind of knew that these people kind of knew something about me that I didn't really know, and I kind of knew. And at the end of the meeting, this guy, you know that you kind of know, but you're not sure what you know, but you know. This guy comes up to me at the end of the meeting and says to me what I believe today to be the most ridiculous question I've ever been asked. And if you're new tonight, and there are some new guys here, and I want to welcome you, and if I get to talk to you at the end of the meeting, I will probably ask you the same question. Not because I want to ask stupid questions, but because I don't know how to invoke miracles. I'm not a miracle worker. I'm a tool that God sometimes chooses to use, but I'm a human being that makes a lot of mistakes. So I don't know what to say to invoke the miracle that happens here. So he didn't know what to say, so he said something stupid. He said to me, "Do you want to get sober?" I'm thinking, no. No, I don't want to get sober. See, my life is garbage. See, I'm a guy who you've been telling since he was a little boy has a lot of potential. And I've spilt all my potential on barrooms and crack house floors. I don't want to get sober. There's nothing good in my life. What for? I have no hope, no future, no family that cares about me, no loved ones, no friends. Every relationship that's been in my life, I have somehow gotten in the middle of and destroyed it. I don't want to get sober. I got one thing in my life. I've got the dream, the hope that maybe, just maybe, not every time, but sometimes when I crack that bottle, I get a little relief. It's all I got. I don't want to give that up. It's not what I said. Because I needed a pack of cigarettes and I needed some. So I said, yes, I want to get sober. And he came up next with what I think has to be a corker, a beaut, even better than the first. He says, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober?" And I don't know what any lengths is. I think it might be homosexual in connotation. Now that if that's your bag, God bless you, but it ain't mine. And who knows what would have happened, because I was desperate, you know. But you know what? Guys have said all kinds of wacky things to me. If you've struggled the way I've struggled, you've heard this one. "Are you ready yet?" "Am I ready? Are you done? Am I done?" That's a good question for a guy that's been contemplating suicide as a good option for his life for the last year. Am I done? As if everything that you and I bet our lives on is a lie. That alcoholism is not a disease after all. It is a series of bad choices, poor morals, choice in whether or not we're done. But I say that stuff to people because I don't know what to say. I don't know how to invoke a miracle, so these are the questions that I ask. And I ask them. If you ask them and you think I'm knocking you, I ain't knocking you because I ask them. I don't know what else to say. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says this about a guy who's at that place I was at on July 17, 1996. It says there'll come a time in every man's life when he cannot imagine life without alcohol. That day came very, very soon after my 9th birthday. Because it felt to me like there was something missing in my life and I discovered it in the bottle. It felt to me like I had an alcohol deficiency. And the minute I found that stuff, the minute I got that whew, that a guy like me gets from a bag or a bottle, I could not imagine living my life on a long-term daily basis without that effect. But then it says there'll come a time in his life where he cannot imagine life either with or without alcohol. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And that was me. If I could have killed myself, I would have. But you know what the truth is about me? After all of it, at the end, after I've burned every relationship, done every rotten thing, after I'm crying on my knees, begging a God I don't believe in to help me, I'm too pathetic to end my own life. I don't even have that. And that is a jumping off place. The book talks about knowing a loneliness such as few do. It settles, becoming ever blacker. And, you know, not everybody that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic of my type. It doesn't mean they're not alcoholics. Bill Wilson leaves the door open to many types of alcoholics. But he talks about alcoholics of my type. I am a man who, that when I start to drink, I don't know when it's going to end. And when I am in a state of abstinence, I am driven by feelings the book calls restless, irritable, and discontented. And that is an understatement for those of us that have felt the lash of alcoholism, those of us that suffer from alcoholism. And I have suffered from alcoholism. And there's no way out for me. And I go to that stinky little club, not imagining that life could begin there for me. Going there to wait. Wait for what? Wait for the next drunk. When's it coming? I don't know. But it's coming. Because it always does. A guy like me always drinks again. You know, one of the things that I used to think about Alcoholics Anonymous is that there was this group of guys, and they were weird. They just were. They reminded me of, and forgive me because I don't mean anything by this, but they reminded me of the Mormons, Jehovah's Witness, and born-again Christians who used to knock on my door on Sunday morning with a Bible in their hand and their eyes glazed over, trying to tell me how my life could get wonderful. And they were the same guys, but they had a blue book under their arm. And they would talk about sponsorship and steps and home groups. And, oh, they were annoying. I had to get a sponsor just so I could tell them I had one. You know, who's your sponsor? Bill. Bill who? Don't know. You know, Bill. Talked to him lately? No, he hasn't called. I gave him my number, but he's a busy guy. But after you're broken and you're no longer witty or funny and you're not the guy that's good at cribbage anymore and you don't want to play pool and you don't want to talk about somebody's rotten day at work because you know that inside they can't possibly feel how you feel. They're the only guys that want to talk to you anymore. And I got lucky. There are guys in this room that were part of the group that picked me up. There are guys in this room that said things to me like, we don't care if you're heartbroken. Would you get in the car? We're going for coffee. Want to come? Don't have any money. Didn't ask you if you had any money. Wasn't the question. The question was, do you want to go for coffee? Who's your sponsor? You stuttered. You don't have one. Better get one. You know? Have you read the book? The what? The book. Come to my house. We'll read it together. Your house? Yeah, let's go. What? Okay. And I got lucky. I got to do my fourth step when I was 25 days sober. I know. That's way too fast. At one step a year, I was racing through the steps. An old man, he wasn't my sponsor, and he might be here tonight, but an old man who's been sober a long time said to me, you're a drowning man. When do you want the life preserver? Now, or do you want to wait a while? How long can you tread water, kid? Not that long. 27 days sober, I did my fifth step. A lot of people told me I was bound to drink. That's way too fast. The big book says that we shouldn't rush and you shouldn't let somebody else rush you through, but it does give you an idea of the pace. After your fifth step, it says that you should pause for an hour. It does. It says things like next and right away and at once and now you can rest. Good, I can rest. Do I get 2 weeks off with pay? No, you get an hour. An hour? That's not fair. They talked about God. God is tough for me. I'm Jewish, right? And this is America, and it was 1996. And you people say God as you understand him. But who do you think you're kidding? We know who you mean. We know who he is. And my ancestors killed him. And you know, you must have written that line for someone way less sharp than I am, because I ain't playing, you know. You do the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. It's just, I can't do it. I can't do it for a couple of reasons. I can't do it because I can't do your brand. I can't do your brand because I was beaten up by people who thought I was wrong for having my brand and you were right for having your brand. Can't do your brand because it was drilled into me since I was knee-high to a grasshopper that your brand was wrong. I can't do your brand. I can't do my brand. You know, you guys are lucky. You know the Ten Commandments? Did you know they're the first ten? 613. When I was 9 years old, I went to a Jewish school, had to wear a fancy little shawl called a tzitzit. Got a certain number of threads, certain number of knots. Tie the knots in a certain little fashion. Then you do a mathematical algorithm to figure out that these threads times these knots divided by something equals 613. There are 613 reasons why God can't like me. And just in case I forget, they taught me a song. 613 rules in the Torah. Oh, God. Can't do yours, can't do mine. This ain't gonna work. Sandy B has the best description of step two I ever heard. He said one day, I heard him in this room and I'd heard him many times before, saying that step two is not a decision to turn toward God at all. It's not what it is. It's a decision to say that what I've been doing isn't working. And I hope that there's a God. I don't really believe it, but I hope so. And I'm going to act as if you boobs are right. And if I'm lucky, maybe you will be. I wasn't going to do this. I'm going to tell you about my last couple of days. I'm going to tell you for a couple of reasons. I'm going to tell you because I want to share with you all of me because you are my family. And I'm going to share with you because it affects my family. And my wife is a member of this group, and I asked her for permission to share this with you, and she gave me permission because she doesn't want no drama from the group. She doesn't want 100 phone calls or people giving her hugs. But we were pregnant, and now we're not. And that's a tough deal. It's the kind of thing that makes a guy like me say, hey, God, you know, what's up? Hey, God, I mean, should I be helping three more of your kids? You know, should I be going to two more of your meetings? Should I be praying more? You know, what's the deal? That's not the deal. You know what the truth is about my life? I'm like a three-year-old. I get sober. I was a homeless dope fiend, unlovable, without a family. Today, I have the most beautiful wife and the most wonderful marriage that I could ever have designed. We have a healthy child. He's 3 and a half, almost 4. And he's a miracle because we've been pregnant a bunch and we've not been pregnant a bunch. And he's the guy that shouldn't exist. And he does, right? And he's a miracle. My mom, when her and her husband retired, could have lived anywhere in the world. And they decided to come live in Las Vegas. My dad has a lot of kids. He spent Father's Day at my house. I have a career that I don't deserve. I got some material stuff that's kind of cool. You know, I like it. And for me to question why God did that to us would be like me saying, God, you gave me all these gifts. But that's not enough. I want one more. And I'm like that. I'm like that every day in my life when the little things happen. And it takes something big for me to realize that. It takes a tragedy for me to realize that. And I was at my sponsor's house not so long ago, crying about something silly. You ever do that? You know, it don't seem silly at the time, does it? You know what the difference is between something silly and something major? If it's happening to you, it's silly. But when it's happening to me, boy, I was crying about something silly. And we talked for a long time, and after some time, he says to me, "What's going on?" Because I had this faraway look in my face. He said, "What's going on?" So you know the only thing that's wrong with my life? Is that it's wasted on an ungrateful schmuck like me. Because I'm a blessed guy. I'm going to tell you about my journey to God. I'm going to tell you about my journey from being broken at 27 days away from a drink to being the guy that stands here now. And it's really the story of the process. It's the story of the steps. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened when I did my false step. The first name on my false step was my dad. If you're new and you're getting ready to write a false step or you're thinking about writing a false step, by the way, working on a false step involves a pencil and a piece of paper. Everything else, when you say you're working on your false step, what you mean is you're thinking about your false step, talking about your false step, worrying about your false step, planning to maybe do your false step, but unless there's a piece of paper and a pen involved, it is not working on your false step. And if you're getting ready to do your false step, we could fill out the first few names for you. It goes your dad, your mom, your brother, your sister, your current spouse, your boss, the spouse before your current spouse, the boss before your current boss, and the spouse before that. And everything, all that changes between us is the details. The story's always the same. And my dad was the first name on the list, and my dad left when I was 2 years old, and I hated him. Because we went from a really nice house in a really nice, protected little Jewish community to government-subsidized housing in the wrong part of town. And the Jewish community turned its back on us because we no longer fit the mold, and the non-Jewish community didn't want us and because we didn't fit the mold. And I hated him for that. If you'd have asked me when I got here, I'd have told you that the reason I drank was because my dad left. And if you grew up the way that I grew up, you'd have drank too. You know, it's funny, when I got here, I digress for a second. When I got here, one of the first people that I met was my wife. We met very early in sobriety, and she had grown up in a way that I imagined, had I grown up that way, that it was my dream life. Her parents were married long after she left the home. They had a private plane, and they had boats, and they lived in Cape Cod, and sounded to me like the Kennedys were their neighbors when she tells me where, you know, I'm in Martha's Vineyard for crying out loud and all that stuff. And but she's every bit as alcoholic as I am. And I just imagined if I'd grown up that way that I would not have been alcoholic. There are people who've grown up a lot worse than I have. There are people who grew up in homes where they're screamed at and beaten and abused. People who are not in AA, who have cigarettes put out on their arms and they're thrown in closets and beaten with electrical tapes and electrical cords, and they're not fed and they're beaten, and they have these awful lives. And the worst thing about my life, the very worst thing about my life, is that it was happening to me. And if it would have been happening to you, I'd have told you to get over it, punky. But I didn't like my life, and I didn't like my dad for creating my life. And I get to my sponsor's house, and if you've been through a fifth step with a sponsor, if you've had the privilege of taking a guy that's got stuff like that on his fifth step, through that process, my sponsor did the best for me he could. He whipped out his greatest spiritual tool, and he said, "You know, Sheldon, your dad was doing the best for you that he could with the tools that he was provided." And I'm thinking, get new tools. You know, you're the dad. I'm two. You know, that stuff don't wash with me. It sounds like it came out of a therapist's office and like it should probably stay there. Because it ain't AA, you know. It ain't our process. And I can't get off it. I can't get by it. Eventually he says, "Let's stop talking about your dad. Let's talk about your mom." And I have a wonderful relationship with my mom today. I see her at least once a week, and she's very much part of my son, her grandson's life. And heard my wife talk more often than me and her do, because she's part of our family. But when I was growing up, it was tough living with my mom. She had some panic stuff, and she was a little wacky, and you'd go home and you'd grab the door handle, and you just didn't know if she was going to yell at you or be nice to you. It wasn't about my behavior. I could have been a real SOB, and she'd be loving, or I could have, I suppose, gotten good grades or something. And she would have been mean to me, and you just didn't know. She has some panic disorder, and she struggles. Not anymore, since then she's gotten some help, and she's just a different person today. But back then she struggled a lot. And there's a part of me that believes, and I think it's true, that I am not a bad person trying to get good. I am a sick person trying to get well. And as a sick person with alcoholism, I behaved in ways and hurt some people I didn't mean to hurt. I didn't mean to behave in those ways. It was not my intention to cause that pain. And I believe I deserve a little forgiveness because what is wrong with me is an illness and it is out of my control. But if I'm going to expect that, I must be willing to give it. And when he said that to me, I said, well, he said, what the book says is that we realize that people who offended us were like us. And though we did not like their symptoms, and I did not like her symptoms, nor the way they affected us, and I did not like the way they affected me, that she, like myself, were sick. Could I have behaved the way she behaved if I had been driven the way she was driven? Sure I could. I hurt people a lot because I was driven by alcoholism I did not mean to hurt. Her disease is different than mine, no better, no worse, no graver, no more or less serious, just different. And she hurt me against her will because she was driven by a disease. And if I want the forgiveness, I must be willing to give it. And I got my mommy back through that process, which is a big deal. It really is. For a little boy to get his mommy, that's a big deal. But then my sponsor says to me, what about your dad? What about him? Here we go. It's dad time. Well, what do you think it was like for your dad to live with your mom? I don't know. Well, let's run down some imagined scenarios. Are you willing to look at it from an entirely different angle? That's what the book says. Are you willing to look at it as if the story you've built up in your head is perhaps flawed? Might be true, but might not be. Are you willing to look at it as if there are some alternate possibilities? Sure. Is it possible? Sure. Don't you just want them to shut up when they start that stuff? You'll say anything to get your sponsor to move on, won't you? You say you will. He says, is it possible that your mom and dad in the late 50s in that small community met each other and got married quickly? Because that's what they did back then. Yeah. Is it possible that before your dad got to know what your mom was like, she got pregnant with your older brother? Okay. Is it possible that he would have left, but he did the right thing and stayed as long as he could, and when she was on her 2 feet and he was a couple of years old and he could financially support her but leave, he got stuck because she got pregnant with you? So he stayed. Is it possible? Not likely, not definite, just possible. Yeah. Is it possible that when you were 2 years old, he left, but instead of doing what he wanted to do, stay in that small town where he'd have to defend himself against her sickness, he left town altogether so he could be the bad guy and not have to defend himself, and she could keep her integrity? Is it possible? It's possible. Sheldon, what would you have done if you were him? It's not fair. It's just not, because when I was 16 years old, I became an emancipated adult. What I did was I took a backpack and I stuffed clothes in it. I put newspaper first so it looked full, then a few clothes on top, went out to some mud and smeared it on my face, then went down to the government and told them my mother threw me out and I'd been sleeping on a golf course, and could they please give me some money so I could get an apartment? Because I wanted to get away from that lunatic. because I couldn't stand it no more. I'd have left the minute I found out she was pregnant with my older brother. I'd have run like the coward I am. What would I have done? I did. And I tell you, I didn't instantly love my dad. I didn't instantly forgive my dad. Because we're funny in AA. We talk about forgive, 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 forgive. And some of us remain angry because here's how we forgive. I forgive you, you asshole. Oh, I've forgiven a lot of sons of bitches in my day. What I got to do is I got to begin to understand my dad. And through understanding is how I really, truly let people off the hook. Through understanding, through accepting that I am like you, through not having to any longer be always either better or worse. I don't have to claw myself to the top of the heap, else bury myself beneath it. But I can be you, one of you, together for the first time in my life. And I tell you, when a male gets back his daddy, which is what happened, he also loses his insistence on fighting all kinds of authority. He also loses his insistence in fighting his boss and the law. And all these things happen. And when he gets back his mommy, he's able for the very first time in his life to relate to another woman on a level where he can be a partner, where he doesn't have to dominate nor be dominated by. And if those things aren't big in your life, believe me, they're the story of mine. I have become a whole purpose because of that part of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then through 6 and 7, the best description I've ever heard of 6 and 7 came from a guy called Bob Bezanz. And you know, they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that if you say something 3 times and you give the guy credit for it, it becomes yours. I must have given Bob credit for this 1,000 times because it's beyond me. And probably Bob Bezanz heard it from someone else too, but it's beautiful. In step 7, he talks about how a farmer does not really farm. What he does is he creates a fertile environment in which growth can take place, then God grows. And a doctor doesn't really heal. What he does is he creates a sterile environment in which healing can take place, and then God heals. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not work on my character defects. God help you if I tell you I am. If I'm working on my anger, stay back 6 feet. If I'm working on my honesty, don't leave your wallet laying around. And if I'm working on my lust, you better keep your women and children inside. I don't work on my character defects. I try and create an environment in which God can enter, and God works on my character defects. And do you know where I meet God after it's all said and done? I meet him in step 9. I didn't meet him before. See, if I could meet God in step 2 or step 3, we wouldn't need a 12-step program, right? If I could meet God in step 2 or step 3, we'd have a 4-step program. Step 1, I have a problem. Step 2, God's a solution. Step 3, hi, God, I'm Sheldon, cure me. Step 4, buy a van conversion and sleep with newcomer chicks, right? That would be a great program, wouldn't it? I'd be my kind of deal, you know. But in step 9, I first introduced myself to God. Because in step 9, I start to buy back my self-respect the same way I spent it. A nickel and a dime at a time. And in step 9, I meet him really, truly, eye to eye for the first time. And I meet him in the eye of someone who I've hurt. When I say, I hurt you. And I didn't mean to hurt nobody, but I did hurt you. And I'm not going to tell you I'm sorry. I just want to make it right. What will it take? Here's what it'll take. I'm going to do my best to accomplish that. And then you say that to your mom, and then you do it. And then a year later, she says, son, I'm proud of you. And God just spoke to you. Or when your dad says to you, you know you've changed. Or when your brother says to you, I need help. And you're the guy that can help. And you meet God. And then in step 10, you make sure you keep the channel clear because I am very fallible. There are some of you in this room that have some stories and some gossip, and some of it's true and some of it isn't, about what kind of an SOB I am, and I'm that kind of SOB. And thank God this step 10. Thank God I'm not perfect. I've been on this kick lately. Every time I share it, I've said this, and I love this. I love that in the fifth chapter it says that none of us have been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to this, these steps, these principles. Let me tell you something. Break that down. None of us, not you and not me, not Bill Wilson, not Dr. Bob, not even Bob Darrell, right? I had to have one shot. He's in Canada, so I had to have one. But none of us have been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence. Think about that. Anything like. That means if you were to paint the picture of my life and then list the principles and look at them. Principles, Sheldon's life. Principles, Sheldon's life. It's nothing like anything like perfect adherence to these principles, for we are not saints. Therefore, they invented step 10. And in step 11, a guy like me that struggles so with God, I don't know his name. Some of you know his name. I don't know his name. Some of you know his favorite day of the week. I don't know his favorite day of the week. Some of you know his birthday. God bless you. I don't know his birthday. I don't know. And in step 12, we really get to know God. In step 12, that becomes a relationship. Bob taught me a little poem that's kind of cute and dinky, and it says, I sought myself and I could not see. I sought my God and he eluded me. So I sought my brother and I found all three. And it is in step 12 that I find myself, and it is in step 12 that I find my God. And I am a worse sponsor than I want to be, and a worse sponsor than I hope to be, and a better sponsor than I've ever been before. And hopefully I will continue down a road of growth in that area. Hopefully I'll get to continue to help God's kids. It's funny. I have cried a lot the last 2 days. And in all honesty, I have never cried, God, why me? And I have never cried, a drink would make it better. I've cried because sometimes I'm hurt, and I've cried sometimes because my wife hurts. I've cried because God's will and my will didn't seem to line up this time. But life is good. For a drunken bum to have the life that I have today, things are good. I'll tell you a little story and then I'll be quiet. A few years ago, I was getting some groceries for the house for Christmas, because I told my wife I'll go to the store once a year, and Christmas seems like a good enough time as any. So I was doing the shopping, throw her a bone every now and again. I'm in the line of the grocery store, and the Jingle Bell Christmas stuff's playing, and there's this lady, and she was beautiful. She was dressed up to the nines, and she had the hair and the makeup and the fingernails and the fancy clothes, and she had a little kid with her in a carriage, and he was dressed up nice, and they were smiley and happy, and she said, hello, and I said, hello, and she said, Merry Christmas, and I said, Merry Christmas, and we were in line together waiting to check out, and we get to the part of the line where the candy is. And the little kid says, Mommy, can I have a chocolate bar? And she says, no, honey, you don't need a chocolate bar. When you get home, we'll get you an apple. And he said, but I want a chocolate bar. Mommy, 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 I want a chocolate bar, mommy. Get me a chocolate bar. I want some chocolate. And she said, no, dear. When we get home, maybe we'll have a banana. I don't want a banana. I want chocolate. And I'm thinking, that's me. She's no longer nice. She's no longer friendly. No longer has a good smile. Now she's telling the girl that's giving out the change, would you hurry up? She looks restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, sometimes I'm going along in my life doing nothing, and my head says, Sheldon, let's have a beer. And my head says, no. When we're done here, we'll call our sponsor. And my head says, I don't want to call my sponsor. I want a beer. And I get restless, irritable, and discontented, and I get on edge, and I say, I'll tell you what we'll do. After this, we'll go to a meeting. My head says, I hate meetings. We'll read the big book. I don't like the big book. I want a beer. You know what she did? She bought him some chocolate. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? I got a kid. I got a miracle child. Some of you know my kid. He's a good kid. But he's 3 and a half, almost 4. And sometimes he does that little tantrum thing that they do, right? I learned something. We got videotapes of the Wiggles. You guys might not know who the Wiggles are. They're like the Barney of today, right? You plug that, he's screaming, I want this, I want this. You plug in one of those tapes and he goes, and he's in control. That's what this place is like for me. I come here, I check in with you. I'm having a tough time. I call one of the guys I know and I cry on the phone. And I plug in. And my life seems to work today. If you're new and you're struggling and you're going in and out and you don't understand and you don't feel like you're home, I understand. I ask if you're new that you will do the one thing that I was able to do. Don't give up. This might be the time you get sober, but it might not. And don't let me scare you away when I say to you next time I see you, are you done yet? Don't let me scare you away if I say, so do you want to get sober? And are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? Keep showing up. Keep showing up and keep showing up. And if you've been here for a while and you're dying, and you think that if you ever get well enough, then maybe you'll work them steps, try the steps anyway. Get involved. Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll tell you this and I'll be quiet. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a buffet. You don't take what you like and leave the rest behind. If I did that, I'd take your women and your money. You got nothing else I want. Half measures avail us nothing. This is an entire package. These are the steps we took. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Here are some simple directions that will help you recover. You may be asking what you have to do. Alcoholics Anonymous is a neat deal. It has changed my life and this group. You're my people. It has been a pleasure to come and share with my family tonight. Thank you for having me.